More than 3,500 Russians, including 135 divers on 45 ships, are sweeping across the four-mile-wide site of yesterday's plane crash that killed all on board, including dozens of beloved singers in Russia's world-famous military choir and a doctor known for her charity work. They were all heading to Russia's airbase in Syria. Now, last week in Turkey, a man shouted out criticism of Russia's role in bombing Syria right after that man assassinated the country's ambassador to Turkey. But Russian officials say they're looking at mechanical problems that may have caused the crash, not terrorism. Still, it comes as the world is assessing security. Jim Walsh is here now, security analyst. He's with MIT Security Studies Program. He joins us in the studio. So, Jim, you know, we're in holiday here, so happy approaching New Year.
Thank you.
And as this year ends, despite the tremendously sad headlines out of Russia, Russia won in Syria, didn't it?
Well, it all depends on when you judge that. Certainly, you could say right now, for a relatively modest investment, their side, Mr. Assad, is winning. And as a result, they get to keep their bases in Syria, which is one of the main interests that they were trying to protect.
And to jump in to explain, they were backing the President Assad against the civilians that had risen up against him and ISIS fighters that had also come into the fray. And they were doing these bombing runs, really criticized around the world for the civilians who were killed.
Absolutely. Bombing hospitals, targeting civilians. So certainly advantage Russia right now in terms of their objectives. But, you know, the game is not over. The costs are still to be accounted for. This is one. Sometimes you die in battle. Sometimes you die because there are mechanical accidents or other sorts of mishaps. That's the cost of war. And, of course, terror attacks. So it all depends on how long this goes on for. Just because Mr. Assad took Aleppo doesn't mean Syria is going away next week or next year. So, yes, I think the Russians have gotten what they wanted at a relatively modest cost to them. But the bill has not been fully paid.
Yeah, well, and when you reference, you know, sometimes you die, these people would not be going to an airbase in Syria
exactly.
If not to entertain the troops that are there.
Exactly.
Well, you say you divide things that we should think about in the year to come, you know, between the fight's over, the fight's not over. Take that up.
You know, traditional security studies way of thinking about this is there's stuff that you care about, you know, that's important. For example, it seems like in Turkey, because of the purges, this is drifting towards, you know, a dictatorship. And Turkey's a member of NATO. That's important. Or a famine in Nigeria. Important. But we're not going to fight over that. That's not a vital national interest. As opposed to the really, really big things, we have troops in Afghanistan. We have troops in Iraq, in Syria, North Korea. That could go really badly. So I sort of divide them up between the things, yes, we care about and we want to do something about them, like a famine, but the things we're willing to shoot bullets over and that are really could threaten directly American citizens, terrorism, wars, flare-up in the South China Sea. And then I divide it further between things that are sort of old and new, the perennials that we continue to face year after year, like terrorism, versus some things, you know, that have popped up on the agenda that no one saw coming.
Like what?
Well, I think in the last month, the president-elect has reopened the issue of Taiwan. Taiwan is one of the few scenarios in which China would ever use nuclear weapons, a fight over Taiwan. And then just last week, invoking or inviting, if by some interpretations, a nuclear arms race. Folks had sort of thought that was put to bed, and it has come up anew. And then finally, you know, Robin, there are things that your adversary does to you, right, that are they're threatening you. There are also dangers of what you might do to yourself. So after 9/11, you know, we went into Iraq and we passed the Patriot Act. We did a lot of things. Some of them were good. Some of them hurt us. And so going into the future, those surprises, how we react to bad things happening, there's always the possibility that the damage you do is to yourself, that the danger you pose is your own.
Well, and you mentioned several things here. Go back to Turkey. You mentioned the purges in Turkey. This is President Erdogan purging people he feels might have been behind a failed coup against him.
Thousands of people.
You talked about Trump in Taiwan. He accepted a call from the president, the first American president or even elect to do so. China's outraged. They have a one China policy. They don't recognize Taiwan. And also you mentioned Donald Trump seeming to reverse decades of U.S. policy and say we have to build up nuclear arms. Start there. And U.S.-Russian relations, you know, obviously a lot of mutual respect for each other during the campaigns, and now both seeming to be in some sort of chest thumping.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on?
Yeah, sort of school
Schoolyard.
Schoolyard bravado, yeah. I don't think Twitter is the appropriate format for discussing nuclear doctrine. I just don't believe it.
Take that up. As a security analyst,
right.
How do you feel about President-elect Trump shooting from the Twitter?
Well, you know, my recommendation would be not to skip intel briefings and to get off Twitter. Wait a month. Wait till you have a cabinet. Wait till you have a national security team, till you have a secretary of defense, a secretary of state. Decide what you want to do. Great. You want to make changes? Great. You're the new president. You should be able to do that. Then articulate it, not in 140 characters, but in language that is clear both to our allies and our adversaries.
Well, what else do you think that a Trump administration might be facing?
Well, I think Mr. Trump has described himself as a counterpuncher. And so what I'll be looking for is that unexpected thing, that surprise in which, you know, something as negative is said or an American dies abroad. What is that counterpuncher in him going to want to do? I think that's the surprises, the unknown. We have more uncertainty going into this new year in national security than I can remember for quite some time. And part of it is we just don't know what direction he's going to take or, more importantly, how he will react to international events.
Jim Walsh here now, security analyst with MIT Security Studies Program. We shall see, and you will be with us as we do. Jim, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, if you attended a performance of the Nutcracker this year, you saw a stage filled with dancers, boys and girls, men and women. But if you were to figuratively pull back the curtain, you'd also see a huge imbalance in the number of boys taking ballet lessons. As Joy Diaz of Here and Now contributor KUT's Texas Standard reports, some dance academies are taking controversial measures to get the boys to sign up.
The Academy at Ballet Alston is for young dancers who are thinking about pursuing a professional career. But walk into a class, and there's no doubt tutus dominate.
I mean, if you look around and you look at our studios, you'll see, you know, you'll count the boys and you'll count the girls. I mean, and it's a need.
Bill Piner is the Academy Director at Ballet Alston.
How many girls are here?
We're going to do
14 girls.
How many boys are here?
One.
These kids are around 10 years old. By the time the girls graduate high school, they will have spent as much as $100,000 on fees, dance shoes, and training. That's according to estimates by Dance USA. And if they go pro, their training can be as expensive as that of a doctor's. For boys, however, it's a completely different story. They will attend mostly for free.
I had an awareness that sometimes there are more opportunities for boys to get into classes.
Jane Schwartz is a ballet dancer. That's in part why she enrolled her son Alex at Ballet Alston.
Alex has grown up watching me go off to ballet, and he would watch. He was interested from an early age, I would say 5 or 6. Even more than his sister, he would watch the jumps and watch the turns, and then he would be trying to do it.
At first, Schwartz was hesitant about enrolling Alex. After all, boy dancers still face a lot of stigma, but she knew it would provide him with invaluable life skills, and the free tuition sealed the deal. Although the perk has been widely used to attract boys, it's starting to be controversial.
I don't think it's fair.
Gwen Young is director of the Global Women's Leadership Initiative at the Wilson Center and an expert on gender issues.
It distorts the incentives. It's not based on skill. It's not based on qualities and interests. We do not think it's just, and I don't think it is the right way to get at the gender balance that these schools are desiring.
Young believes if ballet schools want to attract more boys, they need to market the wealth of skills they'll get if they study the art form. At the Kyle Conservatory of Performing Arts in Central Texas, girls stream in as classes are about to start.
There's Tatum!
Director Angela Pineda Kyle opened this dance studio 25 years ago. She says boy dancers always went for free. That's just how you got boys in the door. But a few months ago, word got out and the girls' moms were angry. Now, the boys pay tuition too.
I think clients nowadays are just a different breed of client than they used to be back in the day. They want everything on the playing field. They want, you know, total equality. Everyone should get the same.
Small schools like Panetta Kyle's need to keep their paying customers happy, even at the cost of losing the male dancers. But not all male dancers leave dance academies, and those who stick around are rewarded handsomely. While the women will face fierce competition to land a job, most men will get one, says Bill Piner of Ballet Austin.
When you look at the company, it's equitable. You've got the same number of guys as you do, men as you do women.
Piner says his academy and many others will do whatever it takes to strike that balance. They'll host a boys' day out to build camaraderie and even bake cookies to keep them coming. Still, the number of boys in ballet is not rising, and girls and their parents are beginning to speak up. For Here and Now, I'm Joy Diaz.
And that is the Jana Gana Mana, the national anthem of India. Earlier this month, an Indian author was detained and charged with sedition, accused of disrespecting this song in a Facebook post. Those charges have since been dropped, but in recent weeks, 12 people were arrested at a movie theater, accused of not standing for the anthem, disobeying a Supreme Court ruling that everyone must, and that the anthem must be played in theaters. Here in the U.S., there's been controversy over some athletes taking a knee during the anthem, not standing in protest of racial inequities. That and the news from India got us thinking about anthems. So who better to call than Alex Marshall, author of Republic or Death, travels in search of national anthems. He joins us from London. And Alex, how far and wide have you gone to hear anthems?
Far too far, I think most people would say. I've traveled everywhere from Japan to Paraguay, South Africa to Kazakhstan. These songs are just so vital, which most people don't understand. They sum up our feelings about nationalism and our countries, but they can also stir passions, both positive and negative.
Well, with that in mind, let's talk about what's happening in India. I mean, all the way to the Supreme Court. How is the anthem getting to the Supreme Court?
It's actually a rather long story, which may give inspiration to any busybodies listening. It goes back to 2002 when a man called Shyam Chusky, who's a retired engineer, went to the cinema and saw a comedy which involved playing the anthem. And he stood up for it instinctively, and no one else did. He looked around and everyone was just telling him to sit down. They couldn't see the screen. And he found this so offensive, he started protesting outside the cinema at first, but then he took it to the courts. And over this very long process, he finally found some judges who agreed with him that people need to stand for the anthem at all occasions, which led to this, in my opinion, frankly, bizarre Supreme Court judgment that all cinemas must play it before screenings. The fact a week after announcing this, the Supreme Court issued a second clarification saying that that did not include disabled people, and also cinemas did not have to lock their doors to force people to witness the anthem kind of suggests it wasn't that well thought through in the first place.
Well, but what has been the reaction? Because we understand, for instance, in the case of the author who posted something on Facebook, students turned him in. So obviously some people support it.
I mean, the anthem has been a flashpoint in India for a number of years, rather reflecting sort of growing nationalism in the country and the tensions between different religions and ethnicities there. At least going back 4 years, people have been thrown out of the cinema when they haven't stood because it has been played in some regions. People have been beaten up for not doing it. And that, unsurprisingly, since this judgment, there's been an incredibly mixed reaction. You've had some people who are all for it and think it's a sign of Indian strength and everyone should be proud in this song. Of course they should stand. But other people have just said, what on earth is this about? If we have to stand, why aren't they playing the anthem at the start of court hearings? Mm-hmm. What's so special about a cinema?
Well, this is why in this country, this has always been historically why there's no law here, because first of all, you just go down that rabbit hole. And secondly, it's supposed to be coming from within your heart, not imposed from the outside. But what do you make of just we're going to listen to some more anthems from around the world. But what do you make of the controversy in this country over athletes like Colin Kaepernick kneeling during the anthem, the football player kneeling rather than standing?
I'm actually really behind it, because I think people should use these songs for what they believe in. And he's highlighted that it can be used to draw attention to issues. And if he believes in it that strongly, I think he should. You get examples of anthem protests all around the world, but you also get plenty of examples of people singing them proudly to make a point. I mean, if you look at the sort of Ukraine protests a few years ago, people gathered in Maidan Square in Kiev and sung their anthem, "Ukraine's Not Dead Yet," on the hour, every hour, to almost to say, we are this country. That's why we want to take power. And so these songs can mean all sorts of different things to people. And I think it's important that we, you know, realize that and respect that use.
Well, and while he may want to take the knee to make his point, there are so many people who sing it out loudly in the U.S., and that affects other people. You met someone from another country who almost couldn't even speak about the line, "the home of the brave and the land of the free," in our song, which some people take yes. for like, oh, my God, that's where they start yelling at sporting events. But it means something.
When I was traveling in America, I thought perhaps the most interesting encounter, one of the most interesting encounters I had, was I just went to meet the composer of Nigeria's national anthem, who happens to be a professor at the University of Delaware. And I obviously asked him at one point, he turned out to be a naturalized American citizen. So I asked him, what does America's anthem mean to you? Expecting him to go, oh, it's nothing. You know, I wrote Nigeria's. I believe in Nigeria more than anything else. And he told me when he gets that line, he realized exactly what America had given to him. You know, it'd given him an opportunity which he couldn't have got at home. It's given him a life. It's given him a, you know, a family. And he said it might sound like the world's worst cliche. And in my opinion, it is the world's worst cliche. It's like an advertising slogan. But to him, it rung true. And when I heard that, it was actually a genuinely affecting moment.
Right. Well, and because it is the land of the free, you don't have to stand. And it's because you want to be the land of the free and not like Kazakhstan, for instance.
Yes. There are a few countries which are almost India's example, India's following, I suppose. One of them is Kazakhstan, where in 2012, an athlete was accidentally misplayed the fake Kazakh anthem from the film Borat. And they didn't seem to notice, which is slightly worrying, given all the lyrics of things like Kazakhstan has the best prostitutes in the region, except, of course, for Turkmenistan.
Well, I was referring to the fact that it's ruled by a strong man, a President Nursultan Nazarbayev,
who co-wrote it. And that's probably why, when this incident happened, and when a subsequent one happened, when they played Living La Vida Loca, Ricky Martin's song, by accident, this law was immediately passed saying anyone who insults the anthem gets a year in prison.
And let's listen to a little of the Kazakhstan anthem, written again by the president of the country, who's, by the way, got statues of himself all over the country. Let's listen. Okay, Alex Marshall, we've set this up so that you could say how awful this is that he wrote this song.
I actually quite like
it.
That's
right.
The first thing. It's not bad. It does a trick. And the worst thing is, I went to Kazakhstan expecting everyone to say, oh, dear God, this is awful. But even opponents of his regime, we would talk for, you know, hours about all the horrific things that have happened in the country. And I'd get to the song and they'd just go, do you know what? It's actually quite good. It's far better than the one we used to have.
By the way, do you know some of the lyrics?
There are things like the chorus is, my country, as your flower I will be planted, as your song I will stream, my country, my native land, my Kazakhstan. He should have really put in a few references to himself in there, you get the feeling.
But to his credit, he didn't. Japan, a lot of tension around the national anthem there. Let's just listen to a little first. Now, Japan didn't change its national anthem after World War II. Germany and Italy did, to separate themselves from their part in the war. There was a lot of controversy. Some school teachers still refused to stand for it. But now, do we understand you can lose your job for not standing?
It depends where you are. But basically, teachers refused to stand for this for about you know, literally been 70 years now. And in about the late 80s and the early 90s, politicians started to get fed up with this protest. And so they increasingly started passing laws saying, if you don't stand, you will be punished. And in the worst case, a woman, you know, she was fined a month's wage, then 3 months, then six. She was moved to schools sort of 200 miles away from her home. So she was forced to commute for hours every day. And, you know, it seems bizarre because it is only a few people and it's almost a complete suppression of freedom of speech and this desire that in Japan, everyone has to work for the group. And it says an awful lot about that country. And I feel very sorry for the few handouts who are just trying to make a moral stand.
Just before we let you go, Alex Marshall, I mean, there's so much power to a national anthem. I mean, I you know, get tears. And yet you can also see how a national anthem, even though you might profoundly love your country, might represent a time in history as it does in Japan, or a lack of freedoms as it might to people in America who still don't feel they've achieved those freedoms. I mean, we can see how it's so much more important than we think it is what I'm trying to say.
I mean, that's what I think is the fascinating thing about these songs. When you dig under them, you suddenly reveal all these hidden meanings, these hidden histories. And that's why I think we should sort of look at them afresh and realize, almost take advantage of these sort of flashpoints to reassess them. And if we perhaps think about them more, we might decide if they are the right anthems for us. I mean, personally, my anthem, God Save the Queen, I think is an appalling song.
Not that you don't love the Queen.
I love the Queen. And I think, but it's, you know, it's musically and lyrically so drab, and it says nothing about, it's actually not really a national anthem. It doesn't say anything about the United Kingdom, Great Britain, England. It just says we have a queen and we'd like her to rule for a long time. And in a way, it'd be nice if we had a song that actually talked about the country. I don't think, we obviously couldn't steal Land of the Free and Home of the Brave for you. Maybe the Land of the, you know, slightly mediocre might work better for us, but it would be good to have something that talked about the people.
That's Alex Marshall, author of Republic or Death, Travels in Search of National Anthems. Alex, thank you.
Thanks very much.
Now, it's America. We don't have to stand for this anthem, but we hear the Queen has a terrible cold, so perhaps we will. Travel bans are in effect across much of the northern plains today because of that winter storm that hit the region on Christmas Day. A 240-mile stretch of Interstate 94 in North Dakota was shut down last night. I-90 in South Dakota was also closed, and many communities in the region are still without power. Officials in both states are telling people, stay home, stay put. Blizzard conditions are expected to subside later today. But if you're not in the Northern Plains, you may be headed shopping. Use that gift card. Make an exchange. And you may very well find yourself in a traffic jam with drivers losing some of their holiday cheer. As we've reported here too many times recently, traffic tie-ups can drive people to extremes, including road rage. So what if one solution is to get everyone to drive just a little bit better? That's the mission of one man in Nashville, Tennessee, through his fledgling project, I Hate Traffic. Tony Gonzalez from Here and Now contributor WPLN reports.
There's a particular nightmare that haunts Chris Poon, and it looks a lot like the glut of motionless cars that appear as we come around a bend on Interstate 24 in Nashville.
As you can see, the lanes on 24 going into town at 10:42 a.m. are at a complete stop. This is Nashville traffic for you. This is terrible. They're in absolute standstill.
The cause of the traffic jam isn't clear. If it's a wreck, that's one thing. But Chris has made it his mission to improve traffic flow in other small, almost invisible ways, ways that hinge mostly on all of us.
We really make traffic terrible the way we drive. It's almost like what you feel like is going to get you ahead puts everyone else behind. If you're trying to butt into traffic, you call someone to slam on the brakes. Well, maybe you got three cars ahead, but everyone else got slowed down.
There's a term for that, turbulence. And it's the kind of concept that turned this electrical engineer into a hobby traffic flow researcher. He gets up early to drive interstates during rush hour. He even studies time-lapse videos of Nashville congestion.
My wife gets tired of me saying the same things over and over when we're driving around.
So he channeled his angst into a website with a map that shows problem spots, like where traffic lanes suddenly end and the on-ramps that are dangerously short. It's a lot about anticipation, and sometimes it's counterintuitive. One tip. Traffic can flow faster when drivers keep bigger following distances.
Some of them are related to just common courtesy and respect, which seems to be a thing of the past with some of the driving public.
That's Casey Matthews, a traffic flow expert in Colorado, who says Chris Poone has the right ideas. And if Matthews had one wish, it'd be that drivers do their best to keep a steady speed.
If you can even that out and get everybody moving around the same speed, a lot more traffic gets through.
Plus, he says that's safer. But how many people would you need to adjust their driving habits to calm the roadways? Matthews guesses 75%. That would mean the re-education of most drivers. Here in Nashville, Poone helps to influence at least the youngest generation.
Let's not just cover, you know, safety. Let's cover, you know, how to be a member of this driving society. It seems like, you know, that's kind of glossed over.
Until then, he shares tips through social media, and he maneuvers his black Toyota selflessly. A little sacrifice for the greater good. For Here and Now, I'm Tony Gonzalez in Nashville.
Maybe you've seen Grayson Smith's picture. He's a live wire, almost 4-year-old with his own Facebook page. Maybe you've seen his picture there. If you've seen it anywhere else on the web, his mom wants you to ask to have it taken down. Grayson was born in Ranbourne, Alabama, but was immediately whisked to a major hospital in Atlanta. His list of medical problems so long and complicated, heart and brain defects, skull deformities, sleep apnea, epilepsy. Doctors gave him just weeks to live. But he and his family fought through 24 surgeries with shunts to drain fluids and countless hospital stays. He is, they know, terminal, but he's also now a gregarious, happy toddler. So why would internet trolls steal his picture from his Facebook page to create horrible memes, viral images, including one of him smiling, holding a pumpkin that makes a joke about relatives marrying? Jenny Smith is fighting back against those trolls. She joins us from Alabama. And Jenny, you know, when I first heard this, I thought this can't be. This whole thing has to be a joke. No one would be this cruel or stupid. But then this is actually happening to many children with unusual deformed faces.
Yes, and
yeah.
When I experienced it, obviously it was the first time for us, but now I'm seeing them everywhere about other children, and it's devastating.
Yeah. Well, let's explain how this happened. After getting your child through these first few years of a life that he wasn't supposed to have, you decided to celebrate him and talk a little bit about raising him, maybe find other people who could offer support. With a Facebook page. First of all, what did that Facebook page do for you?
Initially, I set up the Facebook page for really support for my husband and I to hopefully find other families that had cranial kids with facial cranial issues, hydrocephalus, epilepsy, you know, just other families that we could relate to, get advice from, because we have never been through this before. And it slowly started turning into being a support system for other families as he got older that were also going through it for the first time. And it's just been an incredible 3.5 years. We live a life day to day, up and down. One day he can be perfectly fine, happy, talkative, and within the matter of hours, he could have a shunt failure, a severe seizure, and here we are, off to the hospital. That's how we live our day-to-day life.
Yeah. And by the way, you have 4 other children. So
we do.
You have your hands full. So then suddenly you see what?
This meme. It said that face you make when your parents are actually cousins.
With a picture of your child, with Grayson.
With his picture of his very first pumpkin that he picked out on a field trip that he went with his school, when I finally came to terms that I had to let him live his life and go, he wanted to go to preschool. He wanted to have friends. And that field trip was so special for him to be able to get his own pumpkin and for somebody to turn that into a joke, a horrible, mean, cruel joke, was both heartbreaking and devastating at first. And I actually had to sit there and read it several times because it really didn't sink in. It took me a few minutes to realize that due to his facial differences and his uniqueness, someone found that to be funny. And it just broke me inside as a mother.
Yeah. Well, you said you wanted to crawl under a rock initially.
I did.
But then, fight back.
Yeah. I mean, Grayson's a fighter. Grayson is such a ray of light, and he's very bossy and very sarcastic. And I really tried to put myself in his mindset, you know, because this is his page. We're voicing for him. What would he do? He would fight back. And I thought, no, I'm not going to hide him from the world. I am proud of who he is. We are extremely just ecstatic of what he's gone through and come out of and how strong he is. We owe it to him to fight back on his behalf and let people know this is not okay.
Well, some of the ways you did that, did you contact the people directly who created the meme or the pages that were carrying them?
Both. If I could find out who directly posted it, I obviously kindly told them, you know, this is our son. He's terminal. We've been through, you know, 24 brain and head surgeries. This photo is private. It was made into a meme. Will you please take it down? We've had some people take it down and others say, hey, it's free on the internet. We can do whatever we want with it.
They really do say that?
They do. And so I just am like, okay, well, if you want to spread my son as a joke, the 20-something thousand people and supporters for Grayson, we rally together. I am in several groups for cranial kids and hydrocephalus kids. And us moms, we will rally together and basically go on a rampage on their page. And so far, we've had a few say, okay, stop. We'll take it down.
Really?
So fighting back, it's slowly working. People are getting the message that this is not okay. Hmm. These are people's children.
You've also posted pictures saying, this is a phase of, and finish the sentence in your own way.
Oh my gosh, this is the phase of. We actually have so many friends that have made memes, positive memes with Grayson. This is the face you make when you hold someone you love. And this is the face you make when your life is good. Mm. This is the face you make when your heart is happy. This is the face you make when you're perfect just the way you are. Mm. That's the way it should be. I mean, why would you put somebody down?
It's stunning. I mean, we hear also there's Alice Ann Meyer, her son Jameson.
Yes.
Had mm-hmm. his image posted. I mean, I can't.
He did. And it was devastating for her. And her and I have become really good friends. And it is so nice to have the support to kind of say, okay, we're going to fight together and we're going to come up with a plan and do something for these kids.
You know, Jenny, this is a pretty ugly time. And I'm wondering, you know, anybody who would do something like this, take a child's photo and mock it like that, could be a pretty troubled person. Do you worry about fighting them back? You say you've had some success because of fighting them back on their own turf, you know, on their pages. But do you worry that they're
like death threats or someone coming after us?
Well,
I mean, we've had death threats in the past for Grayson, and we've handled it with our local police.
Wait. You've had death threats because you have a child who has an unusual face?
Yes, ma'am. We have. He's the devil child. He should not be here. And we handle it accordingly. We live in a very rural, small town. Everybody here loves and adores Grayson. But the world's a crazy place. It does not matter where you are. The internet is... it's all internet. You know, they say never take the same route twice. And when you have a child that I guess people feel they have the right to dictate whether they should be here or not be here, you have to be extra careful. But I can tell you that we will not live in fear. I will not hide. I will not hide Grayson from the world. I believe that there's more good than bad out there. And we're going to keep spreading the awareness and keep fighting back. And honestly, these troubled people that do this, which I'm surprised that anybody has that much time on their hands, but if they're troubled or they're hurting or, you know, we don't know their situation or their upbringing. So I just have to basically pray for them and hope that maybe they sit and read Grayson's story and find a different feeling in their heart to maybe change the way that they see things and see people.
That's Jenny Smith. In Ranburn, Alabama, her son Grayson's picture was used without permission to create mocking internet memes because of his unusual features. And apparently this happened to other people. Jenny, I just wish you the best. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
History is the words we hand down, recorded for posterity. But it's also the pictures that tell the powerful stories of the past. And now a new photo exhibit documents a crucial period in the civil rights movement of the 1960s through the works of 9 photographers. David C. Barnett of Here and Now contributor WCPN IdeaStream reports on the power that pictures can have in helping write history.
Oh, this little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Oh, this little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Oh, this little light.
Martin Luther King Jr. led about 25,000 people into Montgomery, Alabama in March of 1965 to promote voter rights. State officials were trying to suppress the African American vote by making it difficult to register. Historian Leslie Kellen says a rigged literacy test often made it impossible.
The white people who also took the literacy test were almost always passed, and about 98% of the black people failed.
Kellen is executive director of the Center for Documentary Expression and Art. The Salt Lake City Group has organized a traveling photo exhibition about that voting rights march and other civil rights events of the mid-1960s. Currently on display at Cleveland's Maltz Museum of Jewish Heritage, the exhibition gives a behind-the-scenes look at everything from quiet moments to police attacking demonstrators. Such clashes in Birmingham and Selma bring back many memories to 81-year-old Otis Moss Jr. He marched with King and for 33 years was pastor of Cleveland's Olivet Institutional Baptist Church. Reverend Moss says news photography became a secret weapon for the movement.
Within the civil rights community was a sense that now all of America and the world can see what we have been experiencing for decades. Here is the undeniable recording of human brutality that many people believed never happened. The picture becomes a message.
Visual editor David Kordowski has spent more than 30 years thinking about the power of images and how best to use them in print.
I think that a photographer's role is to take people where they can't go. In this particular case, there is a large swath of America that just didn't know, never really been covered before in such a way. And to get there and have a front row seat to history brought there in the power of a still frame is just an absolute remarkable feat.
These pictures of protests and violent confrontations between citizens and police are part of America's historical record. Maltz Museum Executive Director Ellen Rudolph says some of the events of 50 years ago, documented in photography, are starting to have a familiar ring.
We can't look at these images without thinking about what's happening today, and we wanted to incorporate that and allow people to make some connections from this history to today.
Like the image captured by a security camera documenting the shooting of Tamir Rice on Cleveland's West Side in November 2014.
It then shows the right hand of Tamir Rice in front of the body, right arm moves to the waist, and you see his jacket moving up.
Such scenes helped rekindle a national discussion about race and justice in the same way that some of these photos on display at the Maltz Museum did 50 years ago. As he walks through the gallery, one of the images seems to catch Otis Moss by surprise. It shows a middle-aged woman with glasses teaching an older man in a suit and tie how to sign his name on a sheet of paper. Her hand gently guides his across the page.
It inspires me beyond description to see this scene.
Moss recognizes this teacher as an activist named Septima Clark. A little-known figure in the Southern Civil Rights Movement, Clark risked her life to run citizenship workshops. Her patient instruction and her pupils' determined look offer the viewer a lesson that would be hard to explain in a textbook.
She is giving literacy instruction, preparing this individual to write his name in order that he will be able to register and vote. There is a volume of history tied into this one photograph.
Such images have the power to tell us stories about ourselves and others in a way that words can't always capture. For Here and Now, I'm David C. Barnett in Cleveland.